Bonjour tout le monde. Good morning everyone. Bonjour à tous. Je sais que vous êtes en train encore de finir votre petit déjeuner, mais on voulait commencer nos présentations. Good morning everyone. I'm sure you're still eager to finish your breakfast, but we're eager to get started on our presentations this morning. Je suis Antonia Maioni, présidente de la Fédération canadienne des sciences humaines. Je suis ravie de vous voir ce matin ici à Ottawa en si grand nombre. I'm very pleased to welcome you this morning to our Big Thinking Lecture with Irene Blomrad. Our Big Thinking Lecture series, as some of you who have already been with us know, brings research from the social sciences and the humanities closer to you, policymakers, decision makers, the policy community, closer to the people who inform decisions about policies that affect the lives of Canadians throughout the country. And we're very glad to welcome you here this morning, especially since the topic of our conversation is one of Canada's most important policy issues, immigration, and as Professor Blomrad will present to us, a policy where we have a measure of success. I also want to thank the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council for their continued support of our series. Merci beaucoup à Chad Gaffield, le président de CRSH, d'être avec nous ce matin. And most of all, today, we are so delighted that we are partnering with CIFAR, the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, for this event. And it is my pleasure to welcome Alan Bernstein, President and CEO of CIFAR, to introduce our speaker. Alan.
Merci, Antonia. Je suis ravi d'être ici ce matin. Je tiens aussi à remercier la Fédération de nous avoir invités à participer à cette série de conférences importantes. Antonia, I'd also like to thank you for all the advice and wisdom that you and your colleagues on the Research Council at CIFAR give to me and my colleagues at CIFAR. Thank you very, very much. And I also would like to join Antonia in welcoming the members of Parliament who are with us this morning and all of you who are joining us in what I think promises to be a really fascinating and very timely talk by Professor Blomrad. Let me also take the opportunity to recognize two members of CIFAR's Board of Directors who are with us today, Richard Ivey, our past chair, and Frank O'Day, both sitting opposite each other here at the table right here. Thank you very much to both of you for being here. And I'm also delighted that they could be here. Unfortunately, our current board chair, David Dodge, couldn't be with us here this morning, but he sends his regards. I'm really looking forward to Irene's talk today. In addition to her appointment as a CIFAR Senior Fellow, Irene is a professor of sociology and the Thomas Garden Barnes Chair of Canadian Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. So actually, people in the United States have actually heard of Canada. Now, some of you might be surprised that a professor from California has something important and relevant to say about Canadian immigration policy. But I want to assure you that she comes by her expertise and interest honestly. Irene is a Canadian citizen, and in some ways, I think, kind of typifies the Canadian experience. So not to reveal too much about your background, Irene, but Irene was born of Dutch parents in Spain, like most Canadians, and grew up in Toronto, Montreal, and Saskatoon. Her story gives me the opportunity to talk for 1 minute about CIFAR. Our mission is to address questions of importance to Canada and the world by connecting Canada's best researchers with the world's best. In Irene's case, that means we've been able to help keep a member of Canada's research diaspora connected to Canada through one of our 11 global research networks. In fact, two of our 11 global research networks, because Irene is in two of those 11. In other ways as well, the CIFAR program, one of them that she belongs to, the Social Interactions, Identity, and Well-Being, in which she's a senior fellow, is an outstanding example of how the CIFAR model works. This program connects 25 researchers in three countries at 16 institutions, including Stats Canada here in Ottawa. One co-director of the program is Irene's colleague at Berkeley, Nobel laureate George Akerlof, better known these days as the spouse of Chair of the U.S. Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen. His co-director is John Halliwell, Emeritus Professor of Economics at UBC, known for his work with the United Nations and the OECD on the World Happiness Report. This program is only one of 11, ranging from cosmology and gravity to successful societies to child and brain development, that are generating, I think, truly important insights for policymakers, business leaders, and practitioners across Canada and around the world. Whether through our global research networks or our knowledge outreach activities, such as this morning's breakfast with the Federation, CIFAR ensures that Canada's brightest minds connect with the world's best to answer questions of importance to Canada and the world. Et maintenant, mesdames et messieurs, j'ai le plaisir de vous présenter Professor Blumrad.
Okay. Let's see. There we go. Okay. Ben, merci, Alan, et merci, Antonia. J'aimerais vous remercier pour être venu si tôt ce matin, puis j'aimerais remercier aussi la Fédération des sciences humaines. In addition to the Federation and all of you for coming this morning, I have some other thanks. I need to thank the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council because they helped fund my graduate studies at Harvard. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that kind of support. And I also want to thank CIFAR. As Alan mentioned, I have been a member of CIFAR since 2007. And as a Canadian working in the United States, it's sometimes hard to find people to talk to about matters involving Canada. And so CIFAR has been a wonderful intellectual environment for me to hook up and meet with world-class cutting-edge researchers in Canada as well as around the world. So merci à tout le monde. Je vais faire la présentation en anglais, mais ça va me faire plaisir de répondre à vos questions en français après, si vous en voulez en poser en français. So today I want to do three things. I want to speak very briefly about what I see in comparative context as the success of Canadian immigration policy. If you look at Canada compared to many other Western nations, Canada has had some remarkable success with its immigration policy. I want to spend more time, however, in thinking about the reasons for that success. And one of the things that I want you to take away from this morning is that when most people think about immigration in Canada and the pillars of success, they almost always point to the point system, the economic selection criteria of Canada's immigration policy, and they will sometimes point to the fact that Canada is geographically lucky to be far away from a poorer country that might send clandestine immigration. What I want to argue is that we have to go beyond just geography and economic selection to understand what's really made the Canadian immigration policy work. And in talking about the pillars of that success, I want to end by thinking about some of the cracks that might be appearing in those pillars as we move forward. So thinking a little bit about what the experiences of other countries in Western Europe and the United States might tell us about where we're heading to in the future. So to bring you to the topic at hand today, I want to take you back in time a little bit to last May when I was driving to the San Francisco airport, actually on the way to a CIFAR meeting, and I was on Highway 101, which is the highway that connects San Francisco to Silicon Valley, driving south towards SFO, and I saw this poster, or billboard, sorry. Huge billboard on one of the most frequented highways in the Bay Area. And this was a Government of Canada paid billboard trying to attract H-1B visa holders from the United States to Canada. Now, the H-1B visa is a temporary visa given to highly skilled workers. Many of them are high-tech workers in Silicon Valley. If you hold an H-1B visa, you're allowed to be in the United States for 3 years. You can renew that visa once, so you can be in the U.S. for a total of 6 years, but after that, it's done. Those visas are usually given, as I mentioned, to high-tech. It is also sometimes used to recruit people at universities. So I actually held an H-1B visa when I was transitioning from being a graduate student at Harvard to my current position at the University of California, Berkeley. Now, as my case represents, you can sometimes move from one of these H-1B visas to permanent residency status, the green card, as it's known in the United States. But it's very hard. And that's what this billboard is trying to take advantage of. The fact that it's hard for people who are on these temporary visas to transition to permanent residence in the United States, and the government is encouraging them to come instead to Canada. Now, in doing this, the Canadian government and Canada as a country is part of a worldwide competition, I would say, for trying to attract the best and the brightest in terms of immigrants. And this is a competition that's getting increasingly fierce over the last decade or so. So countries that have traditionally received immigrants, such as Australia and New Zealand, are reaching out and trying to do economic selection. Countries that are newer to immigration, such as Germany and the Netherlands, have also instituted various programs now to try to speed up and encourage more skilled immigrants. And even countries that we might not associate with immigration, such as Singapore and Chile, have also started these kind of programs. So there is a ramping up in terms of trying to attract the best and the brightest. Now, the reasons for this are not particularly surprising. There are estimates that in Silicon Valley, somewhere between 2 out of 5 to maybe up to half of all the startups in the Valley are started by foreign-born people, immigrants. In the United States, the estimates are also that there was about 1 in 4 doctors or 2 out of 5 medical scientists who are foreign-born. And these numbers are pretty astounding when you realize that only 1 out of 8 people in the United States is an immigrant. There's only about 12% of immigrants in the U.S. population. So we're talking about 2, 3, sometimes 4 or 5 times as many immigrants represented in these sectors. Now, on the Canadian side, the interest in immigration is obviously a long-standing one, but it's one that, if we're considering the demographic and economic future of the country, is becoming more and more pressing. So recently, Statistics Canada has come out with estimates that the median age in Canada is now over 40, and that the number of people over the age of 65 is getting very close to the number of people who are under the age of 14. This obviously raises questions about paying for health care and pensions moving forward, but beyond that, it also makes us wonder about the tax base for paying for things like schools and roads and all kinds of other things, and the economic vitality of the country. Now, Canada's not alone in facing these demographic pressures, right? And in fact, in many European countries and in Japan, these pressures are even more, are coming even faster. And so this sort of pushes, I think, the interest in immigration. However, in these other countries who might be facing these same pressures, politicians and decision makers are having a hard time crafting an immigration policy and one that has public support because the public is pretty divided on immigration. And in fact, over the last 5 to 10 years, about a half of people in Western Europe and half of Americans say that they think that immigration is much more of a problem than a solution for their country. And so there's quite a lot of pushback on immigration. And if you think of Western Europe, we know that we've seen the rise of pretty far-right radical parties from Sweden to the Netherlands into France, many of them campaigning on the issue of restricting immigration and particularly restricting Muslim immigration. What's interesting is when you look at these statistics, there's obviously variation in sort of the public worry about immigration, but Canada really stands out as a place that the general public is not that worried. You can look at a lot of different types of surveys and polls, but generally speaking, Canadians seem relatively happy with their immigration policy. They generally say that we're letting in about the right number of immigrants. And it really is quite different from most other countries in the world. Now, when I teach my undergraduates, and I sort of ask them, you know, why do you think people are going to have more favorable or more worried feelings towards immigration, many people will often say, well, it depends on how many immigrants are there. If there's a lot of immigrants or if there's a lot of immigrants coming in, people are going to feel more afraid. They might feel a little bit more like they're, you know, facing an influx of foreigners. And what's interesting is there's actually really no correlation between how many immigrants a country's letting in, or the absolute level of immigration, and attitudes to immigration. And in fact, as many of you probably know, Canada's among the countries in the Western world and in Oceania that has the highest level of immigration, both as a rate, so the number of immigrants let in every year as a proportion of the population, but also in absolute level. So over 1 in 5 people in Canada was not born in the country, such as myself. Australia has a higher percentage, Switzerland has a higher percentage, but other than those two countries, Canada really stands out. And especially when I'm speaking to American audiences, I like to show this graph because the United States is held up as sort of a quintessential immigrant country, but for actually most of the 20th century, it did not have sustained immigration. From about the 20s to the 60s, there were very few immigrants who were let into the country. And so the U.S.'s experience with immigration is actually not that different than Western Europe in terms of letting in people in the post-war period. Now, if Canadians, both foreign-born and Canadian-born, are pretty positive about immigration, immigrants are pretty positive about Canada. A Focus Canada poll suggests that of foreign-born people who are polled, 85% say that they strongly identify with being Canadian. Furthermore, if we look at the percentage of people who are eligible to take out citizenship among Western countries, Canada stands out as having the highest percentage of immigrants who take out Canadian citizenship. It's 15 percentage points higher than the United Kingdom and over 20 percentage points higher than the United States. And this statistic tries to adjust for the fact that there's a large undocumented population in the United States, so they are not included in this calculation. So this is really people who are eligible to take out the citizenship of their country and whether they have done so. Now, some of my earlier research looked at the gap between Canada and the United States, trying to explain why is it that Canada has been successful in its political integration, civic integration of immigrants. I don't have time to go through all the details, but even if you sort of control for or take into account the different streams of immigrants in the two countries, different levels of education, different homelands, length of time in the country, you find that the level in Canada is still higher than the United States. And what's really even more surprising, I think, is that in the U.S., the benefits of becoming a citizen are higher than in Canada. So if you're a citizen of the United States, you can sponsor in family relatives more quickly and easily, and there's no such benefit in the Canadian context. And a lot of, not a lot, but some social programs are restricted to citizens, including things like federal loans to go to university. And so there's actually quite a benefit to becoming a citizen in the United States. So if anything, you'd expect the U.S. numbers to be higher than Canada, because in Canada there's relatively little less differences between the status of a citizen and permanent resident. So what is the secret to our success if you take those measures? If you ask in the United States, Americans don't know, unfortunately, that much about Canada, especially not necessarily the immigration system. But if you hold up the Canadian case as something that might be a story that you'd want to learn from, this is inevitably the reaction I get. It's like, well, that's nice. Canada, you know, might do well, but they're way up in the north, and they don't share a border with Mexico. And so one of the arguments about Canada's success is that there's no border with a country that is poorer and which can send clandestine immigrants into the country. And the same argument is often held in Europe, especially southern Europe, when people are thinking of migrants who are crossing the Mediterranean Sea from North Africa. And in a way, these people are not wrong. I could imagine that if undocumented, illegal, clandestine migration was more of an issue in the Canadian context, I'm not convinced that public opinion would be as positive as it is currently. Clearly, if you have a large undocumented population, it makes the general public a little bit more nervous about the extent to which government is controlling migration and the extent to which that's something that they can have confidence in. Another thing that people mention when they think about Canada's success, and this is in the United States, Europe, and then I would say our own officials in Canada as well, is that Canada puts a very high priority on economic selection when allocating visas for permanent residency. So if you want to think about immigration policy in any country in the Western world, immigrants are let in in one of three categories generally. Either as economic migrants because they're expected to contribute to the workplace, or they're an entrepreneur, they're going to be doing some investment. It could be because of family, they're going to be sponsored by someone already living in the country, or for humanitarian reasons. So someone who's a refugee, an asylee, who's seeking a safe space, a safe haven. In the Canadian context, recently, in recent years, two-thirds of permanent resident visas or entries are for economic migrants, so people who have been deemed by the government to be chosen because of their potential economic contribution. In the United States, it's completely different. Two-thirds, sometimes more, of people come into the U.S. under family sponsorship. The United States is really basically a family migration program. So if you look at the numbers for employment-based visas, that pathway to permanent residency, which I actually took, so the H-1B to my green card was through an employment pathway, you'll see that in 2010, at about just under 150,000, the number of visas given for economic migrants was actually less than the absolute number given in Canada in that same year, even though the United States is 9-10 times as populous as Canada. So it's really quite a big difference. And then if we think about refugees and humanitarian migration, the U.S. has in recent years been more generous. About 13-14% of the total pool comes in under humanitarian conditions. In Canada, it's dropped under 10%. So those are the arguments that are usually used when we talk about the secret of Canadian success. But I want to bring a sociological lens to this, and I want to draw on some of my research, especially in the Canada-U.S. context, to think about what makes immigrant settlement work in Canada. And in order to give you a sense of this, I want to tell you a story of someone I interviewed in Toronto. So this was a woman who came from Vietnam. She came under family sponsorship. She was a number of years younger than me, with a young family. When she first arrived, her English was quite poor. She didn't have much English. And so she went to a community-based organization in downtown Toronto, the Vietnamese Association of Toronto, where she took language classes. So she went and she took the language classes, and while she was at the VAT, people there who spoke Vietnamese were able to give her advice, information, to get settled for those early months, even early years. So, you know, told her about how to get her kids in school, how to understand the Canadian system, healthcare, all kinds of, you know, the information that you need if you settle in a totally new and really totally foreign country. She did the language. She built her ties with the Vietnamese community. And then when she was eligible, after 3 years, she decided she really wanted to become a Canadian citizen. And a lot of Vietnamese, especially given sort of the refugee past of some of them, though she was a family reunification immigrant, take out citizenship very, very quickly. But she was worried about the knowledge test that you have to take in order to get citizenship. She had a grade 12 education, so she had finished high school, but she was nervous. Now, interestingly, at the local public library, not that far from where she was living, they had a citizenship class. They were offering a free citizenship class to people who wanted to have some help. And she went, and she even told me, and she still was, you know, thought this was really remarkable, they even gave her transit tickets to get to it. So she got free TTC tickets in order to get to the public library. And for her, this was a big deal because her family was struggling. They had, you know, they were recent immigrants. They were not very wealthy. And this made a difference to her. So she went, she took the courses. She also eventually went to community college. She got a beautician degree at a local college. And she then got enrolled in a program for women who wanted to start their own business. She started her own beauty salon, pedicures, manicures, etc. And by the time I interviewed her, the family was doing quite well. They had bought a very nice house in Mississauga, and she was very, very thankful to Canada. She was a proud Canadian citizen. And so we could see this as sort of a success in terms of integration. What I want to underscore, however, was that this was not just a story of her pulling herself up by the bootstraps, you know, sort of working her way to become integrated. And that is actually the pattern you see in the United States. In the United States, there is no federal program for integration or settlement support. There are some very minor state initiatives, and there's a little bit of local or county help, But when I was doing the research in the United States, you didn't have the same partnership between local community-based organization, levels of government at all levels of government, federal support. So you didn't have that same infrastructure of organizations and sort of social, fixed social networks on the ground that could help with the immigrant integration experience. And so I think one of the successes of the Canadian case is this pattern and this approach to integrating immigrants, which is through a partnership model. And I think this is also different from what is happening in Western Europe currently, where there's a lot of emphasis on integration, but it's more of a top-down, government-run kind of program where immigrants are sort of being told they have to integrate, and then you have exams and you have classes offered straight from government officials. Here we have a program where you have community-based organizations that can sort of tweak the programs depending on the immigrant community that they're serving. And it's not just in Toronto. So in Calgary, the Calgary Immigrant Women's Association is also doing this kind of work. And you might be wondering why I'm giving a shout-out to CIWA. But actually, after I finished my research, my mother moved from Toronto to Calgary, and she just finished a 5-year term as the president of the board of CIWA. So I wanted to acknowledge that. And if you look at CIWA's funders, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about, right? So CIWA's funders include the Government of Canada, the Government of Alberta, this municipal government of Calgary, the United Way, the Calgary Foundation, so private sources, charitable organizations, and then also community partners in the business sector. So our RBC, CIBC, ConocoPhillips, and you see this model over and over again across sort of the settlement space in Canada. So one part of the story is just instrumental help in getting immigrants settled, this sort of partnership for engaged membership. Another part of the story that came out of my research is that in Canada, immigrants feel that they have a place in the future of nation building, that there is a place for them at the table, and that they're part of sort of the imagined community of what Canada is. And in the United States, even though on a social level, immigrants can often feel very included, multiculturalism is alive and well sort of at a local level in many big American cities, but at a political level, that's not the message they get. The political level, the message is very much more of border control, suspicion, concern about migration, and that was reflected in how they viewed their relationship to government and their interest in citizenship. On the Canadian side, when I interviewed immigrants, there was very much this sense of gratitude to Canada, partially for settlement support, healthcare, etc., and also this sense that government might listen to them. And multiculturalism played a pretty important role as well because it seemed to include them. It made them part of the country. Now, one part of a lot of the research I've done has looked at to what extent multiculturalism matters in comparative context. As many of you know, there's a huge backlash against multiculturalism in Western Europe. Various leaders of various countries, from former President Nicolas Sarkozy to Angela Merkel, etc., David Cameron, have sort of all questioned the validity or whether multiculturalism is a good policy. And so I've also done some comparative research where we use statistics to see whether you can see a correlation between the relative level of accommodation and recognition in a country and outcomes on immigration. And again, Canada stands out very well there, and there seems to be no evidence that multiculturalism is a problem. And in fact, in the Canadian context, if you look not just at immigrants, but at the Canadian-born, the Canadian-born and immigrants list multiculturalism as something that they find very important to Canadian identity. So this is, again, as a Focus Canada poll. People were asked what is very important to Canadian identity, not just somewhat, but very. And multiculturalism goes over 50%. Now, the other thing that I think is really interesting about this graph is that if you think about what it's saying, it's a very forward-looking, almost, you know, late 20th, early 21st century kind of view of Canada, because a lot of the things that people are mentioning as very important were things that didn't exist before the 1960s, right? So healthcare, the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the contemporary Canadian flag, multiculturalism. So you can see that the nation-building process in Canada is one that's been going for the last 40 and 50 years in a new way of understanding the country, and immigrants feel part of that. So What is the secret of success? Beyond geography and selection, there's partnerships for engaged membership, immigration as part of nation building, and then I want to end on this last note about permanent migration. If you look at the history of Canadian migration, it has been overwhelmingly about permanent migration. So people come, and as they come, they know that they're allowed to stay for the long term. And if you think back to that billboard, this was precisely the thing that the Canadian government is trying to take advantage of in getting those temporary workers in the United States who are in this sort of limbo position between having the right to work but not having the right to invest in the United States for the long term, right? So Canada went out and said, hey, you know, this is an opportunity. Let's go grab it. And it's on this level that I think we have to think about the future of Canadian immigration policy around this issue of permanent versus temporary migration. So a potential crack in some of the pillars is the fact that temporary migration, temporary work migration, has increased dramatically in Canada over the last 15 years. So if you go back to 1996, there was about 150 people in Canada who held a temporary work visa. And if you go 15 years later to 2011, the number's at about 450,000. To my knowledge, Citizenship and Immigration Canada hasn't released more recent numbers, but I think the number is probably over 500,000 now. So you have about 500,000 people who are here on a temporary work visa. Now, in the Canadian context, again, I think one of the strengths of the process is that there are pathways for some of these temporary migrants to become permanent residents. You can think of the Live-In Caregiver program, where there's a pathway to permanent residency. There are some other programs like this. But in 2011, only 20,000 people were able to take that pathway to permanent residency, which leaves a lot of people in the same limbo that was suggested by the billboard. And I think this is a problem for a number of reasons. First of all, it can lead to people falling out of status. They might stay after those temporary visas end, and then suddenly you have a population of undocumented or illegal migrants. And it's a problem in terms of the investment process, the settlement process that I mentioned earlier, because you're coming to Canada and you think, you know, you only have a certain time limit as to how long you can stay. And to give you a sense of how other countries have faced these problems, I'm going to talk a little bit about Western Europe and the United States. So first, in Western Europe, many countries in Western Europe used temporary migrant labor after World War II to rebuild the continent. And so there were labor agreements entered into between countries like West Germany, the Netherlands, France, and on the other hand, Morocco, Turkey, Yugoslavia. They sent temporary workers. Those temporary workers started working in factories and in other places. In 1973, with the oil shock, when the economy turned bad very quickly, these countries tried to end these programs and, in fact, stop them. The idea was that these people would go back home. The temporary workers, they're going to go back home. Some did, but many did not. So some had, you know, fallen in love in the country they were, had built families and didn't want to go back. Some of them had families back in Morocco or Turkey or Yugoslavia. But when they were looking at their economic prospects, say, in the Netherlands versus Morocco, they were like, maybe the Netherlands is slightly better. They stayed, and they eventually brought their families with them through family reunification. Governments tried to send some of these people back. The West German government would give money to help pay for your plane fare back home. Some people took them up on this, not very many. And it was a very, very difficult situation for the government because employers had come to rely on these people. These people wanted to stay, and morally it was very hard to round human beings up and sort of ship them back in planes back to where they came from. So as you can see from this graph, the oil shock happens, but there is no change in immigration. In fact, there's even an increase in immigration as the people who were the temporary workers, largely men, brought their families into the countries where they were living. It's a similar story in the United States. So in the United States in World War II, the U.S. entered into a series of agreements, which are usually called the Bracero Program, mostly with Mexico, but also with a number of Caribbean countries. People came to work in the fields, on the railroads, and this program continued to 64. So for 20 years approximately, you had temporary labor come in. In the Mexican case, people would come for the spring, the summer, and the fall, go back to Mexico for the winter, and there was a circular migration. In 1965, the United States did a major overhaul of immigration, and around the same time Canada was doing this. As I mentioned, family reunification was the centerpiece of this new system. But what happened was there were very few temporary worker visas for these people who had already been working in agriculture and railroads. And there was not that much space for them to come in another way. And so some people went through family reunification. So in some cases, they did have family in the United States. They were sponsored. But in the U.S. system, there are country quotas for how many people can come under various preferences. And what's happened is there's been a huge backlog that has accumulated over time. And because the numbers of people let in various family categories is relatively small, if you are from a country with a long history of migration to the United States, or if you're from a big country, India, China, you can wait a very long time for your relatives to join you. So I actually checked last week on the State Department's website. And if you are from Mexico or the Philippines, they are processing now visas for married adult children who applied 21 years ago. Now, this is a problem because some of the other categories, if you are a minor child, which is actually easier in terms of getting to the United States, if the backlog is 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, long, you age out of the program and you become an adult child, and so then you have to wait even longer. So this is another reason that you have an increase in undocumented migration in the United States, because if you're facing a wait of 20 years and you really like to see your family, there are great incentives to try to either cross clandestinely, come in as a tourist visa or a student visa, and then overstay your visa and remain in the United States. The U.S. has tried to stem the problem through border control, and we see the same pattern as in Western Europe. So in the 1980s, the undocumented population was estimated at around 3 million. It bounced up and down. A lot of it agricultural work or other work in construction, for example, in the Southwest. In 1986, there was a reform, an amnesty, the Immigration Reform and Control Act. About 3 million people got legalized during this period. But there were still large concerns about undocumented migration, especially around the Tijuana-San Diego border, which I showed you earlier. And so in the mid-1990s, under the Clinton administration, there was a ramp up on border control. So there was Operation Blockade and Operation Hold the Line. Sounds very military. So Operation Hold the Line was in the Tijuana-San Diego corridor. Notice, however, that as border control increases, and as the money going to border control increases, the boots on the ground, as they'll say in the United States, increases, migration or undocumented migration actually went up. Anyone want to guess why? Silence. It's too early. Kids? Well, a lot of family reunification, right? Remember, there was circular migration, especially from Mexico. So the people would come from Mexico, go work in agriculture during the picking times or work in the construction industry while, in the Southwest there's probably no off time, but still, it was more seasonal. They would go back to Mexico for the winter. But once the barriers increased on the border, became more costly in terms of your life potentially, or the costs of being smuggled across the border, or just harder period, these laborers stayed in the U.S. And many of them had families in Mexico, and so they were separated from their families, and so more and more women and children crossed the border. And so this is one of the reasons that you have the phenomena currently in the United States of the DREAM Act and the DREAMers. These are young people brought to the United States as undocumented illegal immigrants, as children, often reunifying with fathers who are already in the United States. And so these people find themselves currently in a situation where they have no legal status in the U.S., but they have gone through the U.S. schools. So you have a gender equalization in the undocumented population over the last 10 to 20 years. So lessons. I'm going to end here. First of all, as should be clear, I think we need to go beyond geography and economic selection when thinking about the success of the Canadian immigration policy. I think we really need to recognize the work that's being done by community-based organizations and think about it as a partnership model. In a way, when governments, federal, provincial, local governments, give money to community-based organizations, they're saying, we trust you. We believe that you can actually do this and that you can serve your clients well, that you can build sort of a rich civic infrastructure on the ground. around, and it's a little bit closer to the actual immigrant community, people they know who can speak their language. And those partners don't only have to be government. They can be, obviously, foundations, private charitable giving, business community as well. But I don't think we've appreciated enough sort of the day-to-day work and settlement that goes on in this country. But when it comes to potential problems down the road, I'm a little bit worried about temporary migration. Some migrants who are here, who are going to be hitting the end of their four-year visas next April, it'll be really interesting to see what happens. They're supposed to go home. We'll see whether, as in the case of Western Europe and the United States, some decide not to go home. And if they don't, you have both a problem from a policy perspective of having to deal with a population that does not have the legal right to be in Canada, and what do you do when they show up in the hospitals or if their kids are going to the schools. But you also have the problem that that might undermine confidence in the system to start with in terms of public opinion. So I'll leave you with the idea that I think that one of the successes has been that previously immigrants come to Canada sort of knowing that they're permanent settlers, and that Canadians know that these people are here for the long haul. So it builds a different relationship. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Irene. Merci beaucoup, Irene. Ça a été vraiment un tour de force et aussi un tour d'horizon de nos politiques en immigration en comparaison avec les États-Unis et d'autres pays industrialisés. On a 10 minutes pour les questions. We have 10 minutes for questions. Vous pouvez les poser en anglais ou en français, mais comme nous sommes ici au Parlement, je vais mettre les règles du Parlement. 30-second rule. We're in the parliamentary restaurant, so we're going to impose House of Commons rules because we only have 10 minutes for questions. So if you could identify yourself and in 30 seconds ask your question for Irene. Thank you.
Okay, I'll go first. My name is John Ma. I work for Citizenship and Immigration Canada. I'm an evaluation officer at Citizenship and Immigration Canada. Recently, we finished an evaluation of the temporary foreign worker program. So what you said about the increase in TFWs is really poignant. My question is, to what extent is the rise in the numbers of TFWs related, a byproduct, if you will, of the very strengths that you mentioned? So in the TFW program, we have students who work after they graduate, therefore transitioning into TFWs and then into Canadian Experience class where they become permanent residents. We have high-skilled TFWs who also transition to permanent residents. We have low-skilled immigrants who are a byproduct of the pressures of Alberta, for example, who really need low-skilled labor. So to what extent can we deal with that problem on a policy level? What would be your recommendations?
Well, as you probably know, none of that is easy, right? You know, I have to say that I think one of the things that Canada has done well is that to the extent it has had temporary visa programs like the Living Caregiver Program, there have been these pathways for some of them to permanent residency. And I think in that case, Canada is doing a much better job than most other countries. So in most other countries, if you have domestic temporary labor who comes in to work to help take care of kids or take care of the elderly, they are really temporary. And so there's all kinds of chances of exploitation. Obviously, there have been cases of that in Canada as well. But there is this suggestion that you can go into a permanent situation. In terms of the another thing that I think Canada has done well, and I believe it's following the Australian or New Zealand model, is this move now that when there's international students who have obviously spent some time in Canada, 4 years, you know, maybe more for a PhD, they can then transition again into permanent residency. And I think this is a very smart sort of investment in the money that Canada is putting into the education system to then bring them here. I think one of the dangers is it's still, and that I think makes a lot of policy sense. I think the thing that I worry about when it's like, you know, bringing in people to be pipe fitters in the tar sands or something like that, is that it's still this two-step process. And there's still that uncertainty about, am I ever going to get in that next step? And it's exactly that uncertainty that the government was or is trying to exploit in the U.S. context. So with these H-1B visa holders, there is a pathway to permanent residency, and people have taken it. But there's that uncertainty. And so I would imagine, you know, I'm not someone who is a Silicon Valley investor, but you might be a little bit more hesitant to start really putting down roots in a society if you're always thinking, okay, I only have another 2 years, I only have one more year, then I have to renew. And so I worry about that. So I guess my answer would be that if there's a real need for pipe fitters, plumbers, whatever, in a particular location, why would we move from the previous policy of permanent migration, and what is the advantage of having temporary migrants? And if the advantage of having temporary migrants is that when the economic conditions change, we can send them home, my concern is that the historical record in both Western Europe and the United States suggests that they don't necessarily go home. So it's more of that kind of policy flow, I would say.
I'm Ruel Amder. I write for the West Quebec Post. No, wrong paper. I write for Canadian Charger. And two questions that I have. You mentioned the attitude of Canada towards immigration. It's a little different, perhaps, in Quebec with its Charter of Values argument. I forget what the other question was, but that was the main one.
And what's the question? So in terms of the Charter?
Well, in terms of acceptance of immigrants.
Right. Right. Of course, Quebec is different. C'est une société distincte. If you look at some of the research done, like including the ethnic diversity survey, which was done by Statistics Canada a number of years ago, immigrants in Quebec back at that moment reported no more discrimination, no more hostility in their day-to-day interactions than immigrants anywhere else in Canada. And in fact, on some measures, immigrants seemed to report a little bit less discrimination in Quebec than in other provinces. This was back, I'm trying to remember, I think the ethnic diversity survey was in the field in 2004. So I think in a day-to-day, interaction process, I don't think there's huge differences. And like I said with the United States, that's the same thing. I mean, if you ask immigrants in the United States, do you feel accepted? Is this a melting pot? Many of them will say, no, it's not a melting pot, especially in the big cities. They're like, no, we're like a salad bowl, or we're like gumbo soup, and we're all allowed to be ourselves, and we can be friends. And so at a day-to-day social interaction, I think there's probably a lot of acceptance in all the three of these societies. I think the difference is political discourse, and at least based on my research and also the experience of France, I don't think necessarily that the Charter is going to be aid what the policy goal is. So if the policy goal is to facilitate integration and make immigrants feel more welcome and part of society, I'm not sure that the Charter will actually achieve that end. I would worry, for example, of something that sociologists called reactive ethnicity. So reactive ethnicity is the idea that you become even more Dutch, Italian, Moroccan, Haitian, if you feel that your identity is being threatened. And so I would worry that there's maybe a political discourse that would potentially lead to that reactive ethnicity as opposed to integration.
Irene, I'm Richard Ivey, a member of the CFAR board. There's a concern in Canada amongst certain people with respect to rented citizenship. For example, people coming from Hong Kong becoming Canadian citizens, then moving back to Hong Kong. It became an issue during the Lebanese Civil War when Canada went and rescued a lot of Canadian citizens. Is that an issue in other countries? And secondly, what are your thoughts on how Canada should deal with that?
Sure. Is it an issue in other countries? Yes. Many, many countries, especially the countries that receive the immigrants, worry about dual citizenship. The analogy is often to bigamy. How can you love two spouses? Like, you have to choose one spouse or the other. I think it's the wrong metaphor. I personally like the metaphor of your children. I have more than one child. I love my children equally. There's no choice that has to be made. So in terms of the question of, is this an issue in other countries? Yes. In the United States, if you become a citizen of the United States, as part of that process, you have to swear an oath of allegiance to the United States. And in swearing the oath of allegiance, you have to renounce all former princes, potentates, and there's some other archaic term. Now, interestingly, even though you swear that you're renouncing your former allegiances, in reality, the State Department allows you to hold multiple passports, and a Supreme Court decision back in the 60s allows the U.S.-born to have multiple citizenships with no implication. This was not always the case. So if you think back to the Vietnam conflict, there were Americans who came into Canada, became Canadian citizens, and they got letters from the State Department basically, like, it's not excommunicate, what would be the word, denationalizing them. So yes, it's totally an issue in other countries. Interestingly, the countries that are sending immigrants, they are very favorable to dual citizenship because they want to keep the ties to the people who left. So countries like Mexico or countries in most of South and Central America are allowing dual citizenship because they say, great, you know, you can go up to the United States and Canada, but you can also send remittances back. You can invest back in your homeland. So they want to keep those ties. Personally, my feeling is somewhat we should take that same mentality in terms of those sending countries, I think, in the Canadian case. You want to be careful about fraud. You want to be careful about people who abuse the system. But I don't necessarily see a problem with someone coming to Canada, staying in Canada for a while, and then going back to Hong Kong or going to the United States, and then retaining their Canadian citizenship, because I think Canada has to see it as a diplomatic resource and an economic resource in terms of those kind of ties. Given that we're in a globalized world, I think it's a little bit short-sighted to say, you know, you can only be Canadian if you're living in Canada, because once you're outside of Canada, we don't really want to recognize you. I think we need to think about this as an aspect of diplomacy. And, you know, one of the reasons I always feel very torn when I come to speak to Canadian audiences, because indeed, what am I doing? I'm a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, trying to tell you something about immigration, which just seems strange. But I'm also the chair of Canadian Studies, and I can tell you that, unfortunately, there's not that many people on campus doing sustained research on Canada. And so I like to think that our program of Canadian Studies is sort of an outpost in terms of keeping Canada on the radar screen of people in the Bay Area. And given how important the Bay Area is, at least in Silicon Valley, it's probably an advantage, I think, to Canada.
Very short last question.
Yeah. I remembered the second question. What do you think about the hubbub that the current government is making in attacking refugees, claiming that they're coming here for health care reasons and things of that sort?
Another difficult question. I think the evidence shows that there are very, very few migrants to Canada or to other countries that are picking countries because of their social or welfare policies. So in the United States, back in the 90s in California, there was this fear that immigrants were coming in to use the healthcare system of the United States to use welfare. But the evidence shows that I think the number was like 90% of them ended up in the labor market. They were not selecting California because of its welfare provisions. And I often say to the Americans, if they really wanted welfare provisions, they should all go to Sweden, right? And they're not taking boats to Sweden. So I don't think that people are sort of selecting on that. Now, of course, there's always exceptions. I would probably look again at sort of what's the policy goal. If the policy goal at the end of the day is that we want to make sure that there's public health, that, you know, we don't have tuberculosis going through the entire population, it might be a good idea to make sure that refugees, as well as everybody, has health care. But health care, I have to say, is a little bit outside of my research area. Then you want to talk to Antonia.
Thank you so much, Irene. Merci beaucoup. On est tellement choyé d'avoir eu Irene ici. As Irene said, this is, I think, you're the first American professor, if we can call you that, to come to our Big Thinking Lecture series. I was a McGill grad, and obviously as a Canadian citizen and chair of Canadian Studies, we're just delighted that you took your time and flew across the continent to be with us today. I'd like to thank you all for being with us this morning. And I'd also like to thank again CIFAR for this partnership with the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, Dr. Ellen Bernstein, for making this possible, and we hope this is the beginning of a sustained partnership. Thanks again to the SSHRC for sponsoring this Big Thinking Lecture Series with us. And I'd like to thank James Rajat, the MP who is also our sponsor here on the Hill for this series. And it's obviously because of James that we're able to have breakfast in this beautiful parliamentary dining room. The Irene's talk will be up on our website www.ideideas.ca. And we encourage you to come and revisit what she has said. I thought it was a very powerful presentation and reminds us again of how policy decisions actually matter and can shape the future of a country through immigration, as it has obviously in the Canadian context. Our next event for our Big Thinking Lecture Series is in exactly 1 month's time on May 1st. We're joining the with Partnership Group for Science and Engineering. We are organizing a Bacon and Eggheads lecture series the next time around. So it's Bacon and Big Thinking that we're going to offer. We'll feature, and it's going to be a little bit of a different format. We're going to have an engineer and a social scientist, think about that for a moment, in conversation about the future of urban transportation. So an engineer and a social scientist, I can just imagine the sparks that will fly, sorry for the pun, in terms of urban transportation, and there are flyers in your table. There's also more information about the incredibly rich work that CIFAR does in making sure that Canada remains on the cutting edge of research in all diverse fields, including the social sciences and humanities. And thanks again to all of you. And bonne journée à tous. Merci.